Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 12537, State v. Conroy. Arguing for the petitioner, Matthew S. Koch. Arguing for the respondent, Emlyn H. Higa. Argument on the merits.
All right, good evening and aloha, everyone. The court is honored to be here at the William S. Richardson School of Law. Counsel, are you both ready to proceed tonight?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Combe, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a warning light come on at that point. And Mr. Higa will give you a warning with 10 minutes left to go on your argument. So please proceed, Mr. Combe.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Matthew Combe, on behalf of Sean Conroy, who is the petitioner, appellant, and defendant in this case. We'd like to, first of all, thank the court for hearing this case and also to thank the William S. Richardson Law School for having us here. The issue before this court is a review of the ICA's decision, which we brought up on cert. And our argument on behalf of the petitioner is that closing argument was improper and denied Mr. Conroy his right to a fair trial. There were multiple statements made in the closing argument, which we assert for different reasons were prosecutorial misconduct, which denied his right to a fair trial. With two issues that come to the forefront, one being that when the ICA went through its decision examining statements, they didn't get every statement that we raised in the reply brief and the opening brief. And secondly, that there was an issue with motions in limine. And part of our argument is that the government was aware of information in this case that these two parties were in a marriage of convenience, and the testimonial facts were such that they had a disagreement on the day of the incident, that they had lived as roommates, but yet the closing argument proceeded to be an argument about how this was a marriage going south and that the defendant engaged in these actions because he was jealous and had anger, fear.
But wasn't there testimony from a police officer, Officer Melton, that the defendant made statements to him indicating that was in fact that he suspected that the complaining witness was having an affair and that was that she was fooling around and she was driving off to see another man, if he suspected that. So isn't that in the record? And if so, why was it improper for the prosecutor to argue that?
We would assert because Officer Melton, he reported what he said he recalled Conroy saying to him, but through cross-examination, he also admitted that he messed up the sequence. He said first he spoke to the complaining witness, and then he spoke to the defendant, and on cross-examination, he admitted that.
It sounds like you're arguing the weight of the evidence, and you're trying to say that if the evidence, let's assume you're correct. I mean, did he repudiate the fact that the defendant had said to him that particular statement? Did the officer repudiate the fact that the defendant had said to him, he thought that the complainant was going off to see somebody else? I mean, he never reneged on that statement, did he?
Nothing was brought out in further testimony from either the police officer or from the defendant himself.
So why can't the prosecutor argue that?
Well, we submit that, first of all, it was prefaced in, at the quote is, at that point, I would submit, he's finally unleashing all of the anger, the frustration, the jealousy, the rage. This is the second part of statement one, which we believe as we had raised it, but yet in the ICA opinion, it's also included in subsection M because they did not include it. They only included that first part of section A. So it's that the government was putting its own print on what the evidence showed, but yet when they did the motion in limine, the prosecutors, in arguing to bar 404 bad acts evidence of the complaining witness, they asserted to the government, Your Honor, we both know that this is a marriage of convenience.
It was a marriage of convenience at the time of the marriage. Was that not the representation, as opposed to throughout the period of the marriage? So did that preclude them from relying on this testimony of the police officer about this, the events that arguably then might have occurred after they were married but before the incident?
Well, we would submit they have to base it on more than just the officer's evidence, and what's clear in the record is no such questions were made.
Why would they have to have more than the officer's testimony? The officer says the defendant told me that he suspected his girlfriend had been fooling around and she was driving off to see another man. Why do they need to ask that question of anyone else? Why isn't that enough evidence to allow them to argue their theory that the defendant was jealous and hit the complaining witness in a rage?
We would submit there needs to be more, because the cumulative effect of all of these statements, maybe if this were the only issue that the petitioner was raising.
Mr. Cohn, was an objection made to this statement number one?
There was not an objection made.
Well, Mr. Cohn, let's assume that there is some evidence to support the argument in the statement in the closing argument that referred to this the nature of the relationship. The nature of the relationship, I understand, was central to the discussion of the facts, right? That is, the extent to which there was disagreement, the extent to which there was a fight, that sort of thing. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. And I'm interested in your argument with respect to statement number three, having to do with the concept of sending a message. Statement three and statement five, there was a suggestion that the jury send a message and achieve justice for the victim. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. And to what extent does, in your view, that affect the degree to which the jury is going to analyze the evidence? What difference would that make to just send a message?
It's improper, because the issues here, even though it's an assault case, it's primarily the facts, the central facts, are based on the credibility of the parties, because nobody witnessed the incident, and the complaining witness is very vague and brief as to what she says happens, and the defendant's defense was self-defense, that he was kicked in his male parts, and it was a reaction, and that he was worried he was going to, so our case law has said that when there are cases where credibility is at issue, then
because I mean, it sort of begs the question: isn't it a matter of finding justice when the jury is deciding who's telling the truth?
Yes,
Mr. Cohn, wasn't an objection made to statement number three? I believe an objection was made, and the court sustained the objection.
That is correct. There was, but
so what error are you saying the court committed now? Because the court sustained the objection.
Well, there was an objection made to statement four or five I have here.
What about the statement right after three, even before we get to four, where he says, whatever we do here, we're not going to put nature's smile back into Hines' face, but you can put the smile back in her eyes. What is justice in this case?
That is improper, because it's focusing the jury's attention on doing something for the complaining witness apart and aside from their only duty, which is to evaluate the evidence that's put before, the testimonial evidence and the things that are
presented. Which statement was that?
That was statement number two.
I thought statement number two was that the prosecutor argued that Conroy punched Hine because he was done being disrespected.
Pardon me.
This is after statement three, actually.
So you haven't raised it. My question is, have you raised it as a point of error on appeal, this particular statement that Justice Pollack brought up after statement three and before statement four?
Yes, I believe that we have. I'm looking at statement number two. Jessica no longer gave the defendant nature's smile, so he was going to make sure that she didn't give the smile to any other man. And she won't, and she can't. And in that regard,
okay,
there was no evidence. it would be a long step to say that there's an inference from testimony, because the government was very careful in the way that it asked questions, perhaps because it wanted the benefit of not raising any 404B bad acts evidence that could be introduced against the complaining witness, yet they wanted to argue these things in closing argument. We say they needed to ask some questions of the parties, of the complaining witness, of the defendant who testified.
So your position is the record doesn't support the statement? That was objectionable, and there was no objection, by the way.
There was no objection, so this court would have to find it would have to find that it was improper, and then make the evaluation of whether it constitutes.
So what exactly is wrong with that statement? Is that the evidence didn't support it, or it wasn't a reasonable inference from the evidence?
That's correct, and that the prosecutor is asking the jury to do something outside of what it's supposed to do, and it.
What was it? This is statement two.
I believe so.
What was it she was asking her to do? It seems like it's just a statement, not a request from the jury.
To the jury. On statement four and five, which is statement D and my cert petition, the second part of that, which is the third line down middle, says we all want Jessica's spirit to heal, even if her face won't. But in order for that to happen, there has to be justice done.
So now you're talking about statement five, though.
Yes.
Actually, I think what Justice Pollack mentioned was probably something you did not object to. But in terms of the statement two, where you objected to the prosecutor arguing that that Jessica no longer gave the defendant nature smile, is that not a reasonable inference based on the evidence? Didn't she testify that she could only smile with half her face due to her injuries? And didn't she also demonstrate to the jury that she couldn't actually smile anymore fully?
The statement is Jessica no longer gave the defendant nature smile. She did not share her smile with the defendant. So he was going to make sure, since he didn't share it with her, that she didn't share it with anyone.
Was there any evidence that he had been sharing it with her? It sounds like to me, based on some of the incidents and their relationship, is that accurate?
The evidence that I read and that I understand from the record, I was not the trial attorney, and from my understanding from my client's recitation, is they were roommates. This marriage was to facilitate her transferring her probation/parole from Texas so that she could live near her minor child that was being raised by a relative in Hawaii.
That's not in the record from trial, though, correct?
It's in the record in the motion in limine.
Not before the jury, though, correct?
It's not before the jury. One of the allegations, or one of the points that we've raised is, in the context of that, and given the amount of statements that we're submitting are improper, if the government knew this state of facts, it was taking advantage by not laying a sufficient record and then using suggestions, insinuations, characterizations, essentially saying this is like domestic abuse, this is a relationship going south, which has a connotation in our community, in our society, and in some regards is a little bit sexist. These were roommates that had a disagreement.
Well, Mr. Cohn, I'm just a little bit confused about what you're making of this statement about the smile. So is it your position that if there had been testimony that she had smiled at him, then there would have been a factual basis on which to argue? Or are you saying that by appealing to the suffering of the victim, the prosecutor was appealing to the passion or
yes,
or the sympathy of the jury? I'm not clear just where you're going with your argument.
Yes, my argument is that it's an improper argument because it seeks to inflame the passions and prejudice of the jury.
Are you arguing that it was improper for the prosecution to argue that this was a relationship going south?
Yes, there was no, they other than the police officer.
What about
statement,
didn't your own client testify that he thought she was trying to rub something in his face, that she could do whatever she liked with whatever or whoever?
Yes.
And didn't he testify that he told her, I'm done being disrespected. I'm done. I just want you to leave. I want you to leave. Just please give me the keys. I mean, isn't there at least a basis in the evidence to argue that this was a relationship that was not going well any longer? It appears to me that you should be focusing on the other issues that you've raised as the with respect to the arguments as to justice or breaking her spirit needs to heal.
Yes.
Which does not appear to be an element of any offense here.
Thank you. I seek to answer the court's questions, but I will move on unless any of the justices want me to answer the questions on those issues. Statements 4 and 5 with regards to we all want Jessica's spirit to heal, we've asserted is improper. The government has made multiple statements regarding the physical reactions of Sean Conroy. And under Stacey Smith, we've said that that's improper because at no point in closing argument, he says, rhetorically asked the jury, you need to ask yourself, he's testifying to you, did you see any tears in his eyes? Why isn't he crying?
And, why isn't it proper to comment on the demeanor of the witness on the witness?
It's not in evidence. And under State v. Harris, we said that where it examined what's been done in other cases and other jurisdictions, if the government wanted that, they should have moved the court and asked for the court to take notice.
Isn't that just another way of commenting on the credibility of a witness by commenting on demeanor? And the credibility is clearly for the jury to decide. I mean, the defendant could also say of the plaintiff, did she look sad? And that wouldn't be improper. Would you agree?
Credibility is an issue, becomes a big issue when a case is based on credibility on both sides, as in this case, because based on the testimony of each party, this court has said that becomes a very delicate situation because you need to look at it's a pivotal issue with credibility.
Well, now, so in this particular case, is credibility, I mean, they pretty much agree he hit her twice at least.
Yes.
Both sides fractured her nose, fractured her eye socket. She's pretty, was her jaw broken also?
No.
Okay. She was pretty, he admits that.
Yes.
He admits he hit her.
Yes.
The only disparity is whether or not she kicked him the private parts ahead of time. Was that pretty much insofar as the altercation? But she says she can't remember after getting punched in the face.
She admits that she hit him. She believes that she slapped him. His testimony was that striking out was in response to being kicked in the private parts. And there was evidence from other witnesses about her violent reaction. So there was evidence in there as to how she conducted herself.
I want to come back to the demeanor testimony. So your position is that it's improper for the prosecutor to comment on the way the defendant appeared on the witness stand or to argue. So, for example, if the defendant, you know, looked down, looked furtively, you know, acted inappropriate during the course of their testimony, giggled when talking about some horrible event that they couldn't, that's improper for the prosecutor to argue to the jury that it should take those observations or their observations of demeanor into account? Because his argument was basically, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there was a period of time where the defendant it appeared to be emotional or was suggesting that he was discussing things that were highly emotional to him, and the argument is, well, he should have cried. Now, that may be a good argument or a bad argument, but why is it an improper argument?
There is a case that talks about, and I believe the court has said that when a prosecutor raised actions of what a defendant did, that it wasn't prejudicial error enough to set that case aside.
But the defendant, I don't remember the case name either, but the defendant was sitting at counsel table. The defendant wasn't on the stand in that case, wasn't it?
That's correct.
Well, once a defendant takes a stand, isn't the defendant fair game?
Not if the physical reaction, the way I would argue to this court that State v. Smith says that you need to that they should have brought it to attention of the court, or at least they need to lay a foundation
under that
evidence.
Under that analysis, then does the defense counsel and the prosecutor, with every single witness, need to say, may the record reflect about every 3 minutes what the the emotional reaction or whether the witness is crying or not crying? I mean, that sounds to me a bit far-fetched.
I'm not asserting that at all, Justice Pollack, but in this case where they're asking the jury to make a decision based on the lack of an emotional response, that's a physical.
What's the difference if it's a lack or it's one that's been evidenced? I mean, that's what witnesses do. That's what juries do. They assess witnesses' credibility based upon the way they answer a question, the substance of it, their conduct, demeanor, everything.
Cumulative nature of that with all the other statements which we've offered, we would submit to this court is...
But in order to address whether or not there's cumulative effect, don't we first have to find that a statement is improper?
Yes, you do. Yes.
And do you continue to assert that it was improper for the prosecutor to argue why wasn't the defendant crying, as the Chief Justice has said, whether or not it's a good argument or a bad argument? What about that is improper?
It's asking the jury to focus on the emotions of the party and perhaps a veiled attempt to say, to evaluate the emotional response of the defendant, and that would get into an area of making a decision.
That would be an improper argument? The emotional response of the defendant would be an improper argument?
Of the defendant when because it's being offered for his credibility at that time. And
it's improper to argue the emotional response of the defendant with respect to his credibility?
When he's sitting at counsel table,
no,
or on
this
the stand.
This wasn't a counsel. This was on the stand.
I said, and I was going to add and or on the stand and submit that.
Well, that's different. I mean, what happens on the stand is going to the credibility of their testimony. I think we have said that comments about what's happening in the courtroom really isn't part of or properly part of the consideration of the jury. But the argument, as you understand it, would you agree, was about his demeanor on the stand, correct?
Yes, and specifically whether he had an emotion or not, which fit in with their characterization. I would like to pause at this moment and reserve one bottle.
While you're pausing, let me just ask if you could get back to this matter of what the jury may or may not have been entitled to consider. You have made the argument that by referencing the send a message statements of the jury being told, reach a just verdict, right, to send a message in statements 3 and 5. You've referenced the fact that that was error,
yes,
because it was distracting the jury from its duty to focus on the facts rather than sending a message, right?
Yes.
So assuming that to be the case, can you please explain why, if it's your position, that would be error that wasn't harmless error? As Justice Nakayama has said, there seems to be substantial evidence of the kind of unrefuted evidence of this sort of violence that took place other than the kick to the groin. So really, what difference does it make if the prosecutor did engage in prosecutorial misconduct and asked the jury to send a message? Why would that not be harmless error?
Well, the first step to the analysis would look at improper conduct, and then second.
Let's assume it was improper conduct. What about the evidence would suggest to you that this really wasn't harmless error?
I would submit it goes to that third prong, and that's when it says when it's credibility against credibility. When they look at cases like
I'm trying to get specifically to the facts. You're focused on the fact having to do with whether or not there was a strike to the groin, okay? Now, if that's an issue, a central issue of credibility, how is that issue affected, if at all, by the fact that there was a reference in closing argument to the jury that they needed to send a message?
The sympathy and prejudice, it's a veiled way of helping the complaining witness seem better to the jury and or to in a brighter light. And that's the risk.
And therefore, you're suggesting that the idea was that the jury would be more likely to believe the complaining witness when she said she did not kick the defendant in the groin.
Yes.
Is that correct?
What about the fact that the jury actually didn't convict the defendant of the charged offense, first degree assault, but convicted him of the lesser included offense of second degree assault? Does that suggest that the jury was not overmastered by a sense of passion or prejudice because they dispassionately were able to sort through the evidence and actually convicted on something less than the full charge?
I'm sure that I believe the government has made that argument, but
what's your response?
Still, the defendant has a right to their defense and to be considered without, if there has been improper conduct, to be considered without any of those arguments made in closing argument. And then his self-defense, his self-defense, which the government has to prove, disprove beyond a reasonable doubt, will be more fully considered. I'm going to pause at this time for a little while. Thank you.
We'll hear from Mr. Higgins.
He's the court. Emlyn Higgins, deputy prosecuting attorney for the state. Did you want to start with the spirit to heal?
Start wherever you'd like, Mr. Deagle, though if you're inviting me to start where something that interests me or concerns me, what about the comment that perhaps this is a comment Conroy grabbed, talking about the keys, Conroy grabbed them, tried to take them forcefully from her hand, perhaps mistakenly thinking that restraining a woman was the same as holding her, but that's never the case. Is it? Now, what's the proper argument that's being made in that instance that's based on the evidence?
I'm sorry, which?
Statement K. So this is a statement relatively early on. Said, complaining witness was holding her keys. Conroy grabbed them, trying to take them forcefully from her hand, perhaps mistakenly thinking that restraining a woman was the same as holding her. But that's never the case, is it? Now, what reference is that? I think the defense would argue that that's sort of an attempt to characterize or stereotype the defendant's actions here, but not really based on the evidence. What would your answer be to that?
It's related to, I think, the argument that Mr. Cohn was making, that this was a marriage of convenience, roommates only, that there wasn't any kind of affection or that sort of thing. This is characterizing, this is part, just one example of instances in my argument where I characterize the relationship as one in which Jessica Hine was no longer interested in the defendant, if she ever was.
Okay, I can see that with forcefully taking the keys. Mm-hmm. But the statement, perhaps mistakenly thinking that restraining a woman was the same as holding her. One, I kind of don't understand what that means also. But how is that from somebody trying to grab the keys? How is that a logical statement?
If I'm not going too far on this, but I had trouble when I read that too, looking at it and saying, did I say that? I think what was said, and maybe this makes sense, that restraining a woman was the same as holding on to her.
Okay.
So, and with that, there were several,
that does make more sense.
Yeah, I like to think that I would normally make grammatical statements, but,
how is that not sort of an attempt to stereotype or characterize him in ways that, where is that even in the evidence?
Yeah, it's characterizing him as a jealous man. And where that is in the evidence is, as the court's already mentioned, Officer Melton's testimony where he told Officer Melton that he suspected the victim of fooling around and he suspected that she was going to see another man. Later, after he had beaten her, the neighbor, John Brammer, testified that he heard the defendant telling her, you had it coming. don't tell me you didn't deserve it. She testified in rebuttal that a year before this incident, the defendant had accused her of having a man's name in her contacts list on her phone. And they argued over this man that she had in her contacts list. And in the course of that argument, he punched her in the head and strangled her. So I think those are fairly concrete examples of him being jealous.
What about the suggestion that this was a marriage of convenience? So we have a motion in limine where that suggestion is made. I think you in fact suggested it was on for the record only. Yet, at the evidence at trial suggests, you know, that came in through Officer Melton, that in fact this was a real relationship and that the defendant was jealous to the point of being willing to beat the complaining witness because of jealousy. Mm-hmm. So, how do you account for, or is there anything improper about the representations made during the motion in limine as compared to the argument as it played out in trial, and particularly the argument made in closing?
No, from the victim's standpoint, as far as the statements of motions in limine, that was how the marriage began. It was, as Mr. Combs stated, what I said in motions in limine hearing, that this was a way for her to come to Maui to be closer to her son. So from her standpoint, this was like a roommate type situation. But the evidence that came out at trial was, for example, the two instances that I mentioned was evidence of his jealousy. Now also, although it's a small point, I think it goes to, again, characterizing him, that when he testified and he was being asked about, he was on direct examination. His attorney is getting the background. You know, how did you know Jessica Hine? You guys got married.
We need you to speak into the mic too.
Oh, when did you get married? And he makes a little joke. Sorry. He makes a little joke about not remembering the year of their marriage, and he says, oh, this is where ladies get upset. 2008, I think it was. I mean, that's a kind of just a little bit of a lifting of the curtain. I mean, when you say this is where ladies get upset, if I don't remember the right year, if this was a marriage of convenience, why would anybody get upset if you didn't remember the year that you got married? So it indicates to me his attitude towards the marriage was that it wasn't just a marriage of maybe hers was, but it wasn't his.
Mr. Higa, I'd like to ask you about some of these comments. I'm not sure if this is from number three. The statement is, we should teach her a new lesson. I say we teach her that there's justice in the world. I say we teach her that there can be justice in this, and then there's an objection. And then the court, there's an objection and sustained. It seems that there was a real focus, almost a theme, throughout this closing argument, that there was an onus on the jury to convey justice by returning a verdict of guilty so that Ms. Hine would be, they needed to do this for her, that justice could only be served, in a sense, by returning a verdict in favor almost of Ms. Hine, not in favor of the government or the state. What's your comment about that?
Yeah, the lesson part of it is really where that derived from was the statements that John Brammer heard him say after he had beaten her, that you deserve this, don't say that you didn't have this coming. You know, that sounds...
Excuse me, but is the propriety of a prosecutor's comments to the jury and the professional responsibility that a prosecutor owes, is it determined by a statement made in the trial by a witness?
I'm sorry.
I mean, you're justifying the statement made in closing argument by referencing me to a witness's statement in trial. And I'm asking you, is that how we evaluate whether or not a conduct, whether a statement is within bounds?
Okay, let me bring it back to this is related to arguments on credibility. As you recall, when she testified, she said, I cannot give all the details because it's been a year. I've been having nightmares, and there are times when I can't distinguish my nightmares from what actually happened. And so that's why she testified to very bare bones kinds of things. I'm just maybe a long road, but that is what I was kind of referencing in the statements, for example, about things being broken inside as well as outside.
I'm not even asking about that. I'm talking about we should teach her a new lesson. In other words, you're telling the jury, we need to teach you, the jury, we, it's not even you, it's we, all of us, should teach her a new lesson. I say that we teach her that there is justice in the world. I say we teach her that there can be justice. I thought justice comes by a jury making a verdict based on the evidence and the law, and not based on deciding the case to teach somebody a lesson. And then there's an objection sustained, and then it's right back. Judge, he determines the law, but you judge the facts. In doing so, you are an instrument of justice. Be that instrument of justice. Right back to the statement that's been objected to. And then there's an objection, overruled. Whatever we do here, we're not going to put nature's smile back on Jessica's face, but you can put the smile back in her eyes. Is that what we do in jury trials?
It would be a collateral effect. But the reason I was bringing up the credibility is because of the her difficulty in testifying, and it was related to not just her physical injury, but her psychic injury as well. Now, when it was, there was some question about talking about her eyes, and whether there's anything in the evidence regarding that. This is Exhibit 3 that was in evidence at trial. It was taken, she testified about a day, maybe two after the event. That is a basis in the record.
You know, Mr. Higa, this picture seems very much like some of the things that were used in the closing argument, appealing to passion.
And following up on Justice Pollack's statement, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Higa, but weren't you saying, look at the picture, you have to heal her? I mean, is this an argument that should be a standard argument to juries that now that we have a very severe picture you're looking at, what you need to do is render a decision so that, you know, this victim or this complaining witness will heal? I mean, isn't that appealing to passion and prejudice? And is that relevant, the idea that a jury needs to make a decision so that a person can heal physically?
Just as relevant as asking a jury to hold a defendant accountable, you know, having them find him guilty of the crime that he did commit, that the evidence shows that he committed.
Well, no. I see that as fundamentally a different proposition, and certainly a role for the jury to determine whether or not a crime has been committed looking at the facts. But to go further, I don't know that there is any aspect of an element of a crime that says that as part of the crime, there has to be some sort of healing process identified. And the prosecutor has a duty to prove to the jury that a healing will take place if they find a defendant guilty. That seems to be completely outside of the traditional responsibility of a prosecutor.
I would say it's the other side of the coin of asking them to hold a defendant accountable for what he did.
But what are you asking them to hold him accountable for? Statement number 4. Consider that, you know, when defendant broke Jessica's face, when you look at the way she testified, consider her demeanor, the pictures of her after the scene. She broke something inside of her as well. Objection, passion, prejudice, court says I'll allow it. We all want Jessica's, this is statement 5, we all want Jessica's spirit to heal, even if her face won't. But in order for that to happen, there has to be justice done. It seems like you're arguing emotional distress here. that because she suffered emotional distress, because she had, she suffered psychologically, which I'm sure she did, that should be the grounds for finding the defendant guilty of the physical assault. And that this is a criminal trial, not a civil trial for emotional distress.
It was in evidence, I think, a couple of times at least, about the nightmares that she had been suffering in the years since this event took place. And on both occasions, when evidence of her nightmares came in, it was to explain the fact that she couldn't testify to a lot of detail.
Totally understand that, Mr. Hegel, but what about you're not allowed to argue passion or prejudice? Weren't you appealing to the sympathies and the, you know, of the jury? You're, I mean, and it's understandable. I mean, you have a sympathetic complaining witness, but is that appropriate for a prosecutor to use that and the eternal quest for justice and fix her heart or, you know, her, if you can't fix her face? Is that what the jury, isn't the jury just supposed to decide whether or not you've proven the elements of the offense?
But if the appeal, the appeal to the jury to do justice is based on the evidence, then that's a proper argument. Now, the appeal to do justice, I would say, has two sides to that point. One is hold the defendant accountable. The other is exonerate the victim.
But Mr. Higa, and just the very next sentence, what Justice McKenna read to you, there's an objection to what you say. The court says no, so noted, and then your next statement. Give Jessica the justice that she needs. Give her the justice that she deserves. Is that what trials? I thought trials are to try defendants. It's just as Nakayama just said. You prove the elements. This isn't for justice for the complainant or the victim in the case.
You can't give justice to the victim without also giving justice to the defendant. And it's the other way around, too. You can't give justice to a defendant without also giving justice to the victim.
Well, let's, if I could interrupt you when you're on the part about justice for the defendant. Your purpose in your closing argument was to establish the elements, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the decision that you made to talk about giving justice to the complaining witness, I assume, had as part of its strategic purpose to have the jury find the facts as presented by the prosecution, including the fact that the complaining witness did not strike or kick the defendant in the groin. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but isn't that one of the primary issues that was in dispute during the course of this case, whether or not that happened, because doesn't that go to the defendant's defense of self-defense?
Yeah.
So if we assume that it was prosecutorial misconduct to call upon the jury to provide justice in the sense of sympathy or provide justice in the sense of sending a message, then, Mr. Higa, is it harmless error? Because, as you just conceded, this fact about whether or not there was a strike to the groin goes seems directly to the defense of self-defense.
Yes, and so, but as far as the weight of the evidence, the defendant said, apparently from the record, that he was kicked in the groin for the first time at trial.
All right, well,
he didn't tell it to Officer Melton. He didn't say it at the TRO hearing.
So you're saying that the evidence was very strong in favor of the proposition that he didn't.
Right. Also.
But let me mention to you, because this is sort of a, I'm interested in your insight about this because you were at the sentencing. But the judge at the sentencing actually believed that she kicked him.
Yes.
Which would be opposite to the proposition you were arguing to the jury, because you were arguing that she actually didn't kick it, right?
Right.
And that makes me think there seems to have been something of a significant factual question before the jury, at least in the sense that the jury, you might say the jury didn't find that he kicked her. That's why he found, they found no self-defense, whereas the judge, from looking at the evidence, thought that he actually was kicked.
The reason Judge Bisson said that he believed that she was kicked was that he said that that was the only way she would have been able to reach his head to hit him if he bent over. I don't fully agree with that.
Did you say she hit him
she
after
admitted,
she he hit her?
No, before. She admitted that she hit him.
She said she slapped him, right?
Yeah, while they were struggling for the keys, then she hit him. And that's when he punched her. The other thing that militates against Judge Bisson's finding on that fact is Dr. Don's testimony that when I asked him how much force would it take to cause that kind of damage to this woman's face, he said, well, maybe a karate chop, full force from a fist.
But there wasn't any dispute about how he hit her, right? She didn't dispute the fact that he hit her with his fist.
No, but common
the question was just why he hit her, and wasn't there evidence in the record that previously she'd actually used physical force against him to the point where she knocked his tooth out with the remote control for a television?
Yes, but the other thing that militates against his self-force is that it's pretty much, I think, common sense, common experience that if he gets kicked in the groin, he cannot hit somebody with full force, as Dr. Don said would be necessary to cause those injuries. It has to be a full force punch. Now, how does a man deliver a full force punch after he's been kicked in the groin and he's bent over in excruciating pain? He said it was two quick jabs. Two quick jabs.
Mr. Higa, is that when you said, anyway, I defy anyone to show that two quick jabs are going to cause the kind of injuries that we saw in the evidence in this case? I defy anyone. It sounds like you're testifying. You're certainly giving an opinion.
I didn't say I think or in my opinion or I sincerely believe or that I said I defy anyone to show that. I'm saying it's common sense, it's common experience. Can anybody come forward and say that that's not the case? That if a man gets kicked in the groin and he's in excruciating pain, how is he going to deliver the kind of force that Dr. Don said was necessary to bring about the injuries that Jessica Hines suffered?
In addition to that point where you spoke in the first person, there were a number of others, and in fact Judge Bisson commented about that.
Yes.
And is that an area, either individually or cumulatively, that began to lapse into sounding like you were expressing an opinion or sharing with the jury your view of the evidence, or personally as opposed to that of the state?
No, I looked at obviously because of Marsh, I think everybody is very nervous about using the first person. But under Marsh, if you use the first, it's not just using the first person, it's using it to express your personal opinion or give your personal opinion about the case. Now, it's a big difference, I think, between saying, as in Marsh, I sincerely believe that this witness never saw this, or I believe that the defendant is guilty, or that sort of thing. There's a significant difference between that and making an effective, persuasive closing argument that you believe. I mean, that's what we are taught as trial attorneys, right? First, you have to believe in your case. You have to show, and that has to be conveyed to the jury, that you believe in your case. Otherwise, how are they going to believe the things that you are saying? Now, the bright line, however, is that you don't explicitly come out and express your personal opinion. But you do advocate. And so I disagree a little bit. I have to go back when Justice Wilson said that the purpose of closing argument is to establish the element. So the purpose of closing argument is to persuade. And
well, I'm sorry, I should have been more specific. Persuade that they accept your view of the evidence so that they do find the elements when they have the jury instructions in front of them.
Well, right. Persuade that the evidence supports a particular outcome, not persuade that you, as a prosecutor, wouldn't have brought this case unless you believed in it.
Exactly.
That's the problem with I, right? I do this, I believe that, I defy you.
Well, the I defy you, I submit, yeah, those are, but I never...
submit and I defy are quite different. Not that I submit is great, but I defy is certainly, I mean, I agree with you with State versus Marsh says no personal opinions, but that doesn't mean that the only way you express a personal opinion by saying it's my opinion. We all talk amongst them. I mean, we're human beings and we know how to express things and we know how to express personal views. And when you say something like, I defy anyone to show that, I mean, everybody in the room knew your view, whether you intended or not. You conveyed it.
Making a standard persuasive closing argument is going to convince everybody in the room that you believe that the defendant is guilty.
But there's ethical prohibitions in expressing your personal belief. I think that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. And
you know, I would submit he's finally unleashing all of his anger. I think one of the few true things that the defendant told us in his testimony shed some light on that. You keep using I think this is believable. I think this is not believable. That is expressing your personal belief as to the credibility or the weight of the witness evidence.
That one instance is that I think that this is the one true thing that he said. I agree. That's expressing personal opinion.
Well, let me give you another one. So this is statement 9, I think. Now, the defense says that Conroy's testimony was more credible. He had no duty to testify, but he did tell you what happened. But I would submit that he had to. In other words, you gave an opinion that he had to testify. And frankly, I think it's questionable how you got there. But is he being penalized for exercising a constitutional right to testify? Because now there's an opinion out there that he had to testify?
What I was answering was the defense's argument in their closing that, you know, he didn't, because she said, hey, he doesn't have a duty to testify. He had no duty to testify, but he came up because he wanted to tell you the truth, because he wanted to lay it all out there. He wanted to tell you the good and the bad. My rebuttal to that is no. He had to testify. The reason he had to testify is because he didn't testify. The only statement that would be in evidence is the statement that he gave to Officer Melton, which is a confession.
I'm not so sure it's a confession. I mean, it would probably take a lot more than 10 minutes to argue. But I think that's where it gets problematic. You argue that it's a confession, and just because they're fighting over the keys, all of a sudden this self-defense evaporates? I mean, that's the argument you made. I have problems with that, but even aside from that, when you express a personal view that he had to testify, are you infringing upon a defendant's ability to exercise their constitutional right to testify without having the government saying, actually, he wasn't exercising a right, he was forced to under this case? That's the argument.
No, that's why Judge Bisson brought us to the bench. He said, are you commenting on his right to remain silent or on his right not to testify? I explained to Judge Bisson that no, it was given the state of the evidence, he had to present a different story. The only story that was out there from his side was what he told Officer Melton, what Officer Melton testified to. After I explained that to Judge Bisson, he says, okay, I see where you're going, go ahead. And that was the argument thereafter. It was, no, they're saying, oh, he was testifying out of the goodness of his heart. No, he was testifying because, look, this was the state of the evidence at that time.
How do you know that that was the reason he was testifying? It's pure speculation on your part. You're saying this is the reason he had to testify.
That's the state of the evidence. That's not speculation. That's the state of the evidence.
But you're testifying what's in the defendant's head, and you actually don't know what the reason was. It's pure speculation. You could have made the same argument without getting into the defendant's head and without saying he had to testify.
Okay. Defense argued what was in his head. Defense said he had no duty to testify. The reason he testified is because in his head, he wanted to come up and tell you guys the truth. He wanted to tell you the good and the bad. He wanted to lay it all out. So I'm rebutting that.
The fact that he said he has no duty is a statement in every case that's true in every case. It's not expressing what was in the defendant's head.
No, when she... Now, when she, if she says, okay, he has no duty to testify, but he did, and he took the stand, he told you the truth, Sean was upfront from the beginning, when he stayed at the scene, spoke to Officer Melton, he was upfront with you yesterday when he testified. It was in his head that he wanted to be upfront. That's why he testified, because he wanted to be upfront with you, the jurors. So she's saying what is in his head. I'm rebutting that, saying, no, he didn't take the stand because he wanted to be upfront. He took the stand because the state of the evidence was we had a confession. And he had to give a self-defense. He had to give facts that would support a self-defense, which was not in the record at the time. Oh, and I defy anyone to show. To me, it's basically saying something in the strongest terms that this proposition cannot be contradicted. I'm not giving an opinion that I personally believe that this is the state of things. I'm saying that this proposition is so strong that nobody can contradict it.
Mr. Higa, if you would come back to the issue whether any errors that did occur were harmless. Mr. Combs says it's a credibility battle between the complaining witness and the defendant. And in light of that, close call on the evidence, several instances of what he argues were instances of misconduct where the court overruled the objection, and one that he would argue was we all want Jessica's spirit to heal, even if her face won't. But in order for that to happen, there has to be justice done. Same objection, so noted. So those objections were overruled, evidently. So in light of that, how do you argue that actually any error that took place was harmless in this case? If in fact, as he says, it's a credibility battle.
I would adopt the ICA's position regarding the strength of the evidence, but I'm still not willing to give up on the fact that it was an improper.
Oh, I'm just asking you to accept that, unless you want to waive the harmless error, which I assume you don't. So anything else that you have to argue on that point?
Not on a point of harmless error, but I do.
With respect, before you leave that, when Chief Justice getting you to focus on the facts, isn't this a swearing match without a witness? In other words, nobody saw the incident except the two individuals that testified, right? The complaining witness and the defendant, correct?
Yeah.
So presumably in that situation, credibility is classically at stake.
Right. Credibility is at stake, but there's not just the testimony of Jessica Hine and the testimony of the defendant. There is
about
also
what
physical
happened.
Evidence. There's also
well, that's true. It's physical evidence.
You know, which is most strongly in that instance. So he says she was kicked and that the punches were a reaction and basically the injury was an accident. But, you know, she's saying, no, well, you know, I slapped him and then he punched me two times and I was out. Now, the physical evidence, among the physical evidence is Dr. Don's testimony of the extent of the injuries and the amount of force that would be necessary. And the common sense conclusion that somebody who's been kicked, like the defendant says he was kicked, would not be able to deliver that kind of force. So it's not just a shouting match between two people. It's also taking into account the physical evidence and the expert testimony of Dr. Don.
What, that photo that you displayed to the court, was that in evidence?
Yes.
Anything further at this point, Mr. Higa, to wrap up?
There's a lot of things further, but I'm
well, your time is up. That's why I'm giving you the opportunity if you want to summarize in any way, or else you can stand on your argument as you've stated.
Thank you, I will.
Okay, very well. Mr. Comey, rebuttal.
Thank you, Ron. In the United States Supreme Court in Berger v. United States, Justice Sutherland stated, the prosecuting attorney is the representative not of an ordinary party to a controversy, but of a sovereignty whose obligation to govern impartially is as compelling as its obligation to govern at all, and whose interest, therefore, in a criminal prosecution is not that it shall win a case, but that justice shall be done. As such, he is in a peculiar and very definite sense, the servant of the law with a twofold aim, of which is that guilt shall not escape or innocence suffer.
Well, could I ask you a question about that, Mr. Colm?
Yes.
Looking at the duty of the prosecutor in light of the jury instructions and considering whether the argument that appealed to justice, the argument that was made by the prosecutor, was, as you say, within the responsibility and duties of the prosecutor. There is a standard jury instruction, which was given in this case, you've probably heard it many times, in which the jury is told that both the prosecution and the defendant have a right to demand, and they do demand and expect that you will conscientiously and dispassionately consider and weigh all of the evidence and follow these instructions, and that you will reach a just verdict. So why wouldn't the argument of the prosecutor in this case simply be following that instruction?
In State versus Tu'ua, the court, when they had a similar issue, they said, prosecutor has not pointed to any Hawaii law to suggest the court's generic instruction issued prior to an improper statement can cure that misconduct, especially in the case when it comes down to credibility between the parties. I actually went back and looked at the closing argument today quickly to say, and on page 24 of the transcript of the closing argument, the judge said, lawyers will make a closing argument. What they say is not evidence. You are not bound by how they interpret or remember the evidence. And they went into closing argument. Whereas in Barrios, which considered a similar issue, there was broader language which says the only evidence which you must consider in deliberations comes from the witness testimony and from the exhibits which are in evidence.
So what's your argument?
Is that it as the court noted in Tu'ua, that you'd still have to, just because there's a jury instruction, it doesn't remedy the error if there's been improper conduct. But this court needs to look at all of the allegations, and if they are improper, both Tu'ua and Marsh talk about the cumulative effect.
Now, don't we say that we assume that the jury follows the judge's instruction?
Yes.
And the judge instructed the jury that what our final argument was for both parties was not evidence.
But the problem is because it was based, so there was a credibility argument between the claimants.
What about Mr. Higa's argument that there is, in fact, there is something other than just two people with different views of what happened? There's physical evidence, including the extent of the injuries. How are those injuries... I guess he would argue those injuries are more consistent with the state's theory that this was an act of anger rather than an act of somebody in self-defense, acting in self-defense. What's your response to that? Because, again, that would go to harmlessness, correct?
I have to concede that the court needs to consider that issue and probably in my argument that the prong that I've had to concentrate on the most is that third prong of that harmless, and but still, with that being the case, when you look at the cases that look at similar issues, it's what happened at the time. There are no witnesses. I believe it was Judge Wilson's. There were no witnesses at the time of the actual event, and he has a self-defense argument. And because it's based on credibility, the other evidence is not forensic evidence like in Barrios, where you had the doctor doing a forensic examination of the victim of the sexual assault, and the mother unfortunately agreeing that she had firsthand knowledge that it did in fact happen. There's no dispute.
What about the third party testimony? The neighbor said something to the effect of, well, you hit me or you asked for it. I mean, does that not suggest some form of corroboration for the suggestion that this was an attack as opposed to self-defense?
Well, actually, taken in context, I believe the way that John Brammer testified was that she said, the complaining witness said, you hit me, and his response was, because you hit me. And Brammer testified in his opinion that Sean was a peaceable person and not a kind of person to be involved in something like this. Yet he knew of two instances which he was allowed to testify to where she broke his finger kicking him and broke his tooth in his mouth and hit his face by hitting him with a remote control.
Mr. Combe, on the direct examination of the complaining witness, did the prosecutor ever ask her whether or not the defendant kicked her?
No. And there was some argument here about things that some incidents between where he said allegedly he has a violent background. And while I wasn't trial counsel, I'm not aware of that. I don't recall seeing that in the record.
Let me ask you one last thing, too. You referred to this standard admonishment that the court gives that the lawyers will not make their closing argument what they say is not evidence, and you are not bound by how they interpret or remember the evidence. Yet when they're making the closing argument, the prosecutor says, again, we all want Jessica's spirit to heal, even if her face won't. So in order for this to happen, there has to be justice done. Your Honor, same objection. And then the court so noted counsel. So the court overrules an objection. And in light of the fact, it's one thing to tell the jury to disregard something. It's quite another when there's a timely objection. It's overruled. And then the prosecutor goes on and says, give Jessica the justice that she needs. Give her the justice that she deserves. In other words, what the jury heard over objection was a direct statement for this jury to decide this case on giving justice to Jessica and not perhaps deciding this case based on the evidence.
That's correct. The trial court may have impermissibly put its approval by not granting the objection. And it may also, in that instance, this court may be able to consider that error as not plain error because there was an objection to determine whether that was properly ruled on.
Very well, Mr. Combe. Anything else at this time? Your time.
I'd just like to thank this court again for the opportunity to present the case. We appreciate the fact that you let us come here to UH Law School and for the UH Law School to help us here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So the court will take this matter under advisement. I want to thank each of our attorneys. You folks can remain seated. I just wanted to thank everyone. We have a lot of folks to thank here today for making this happen. I want to thank each of them, Mr. Higa, Mr. Combe, for participating in our argument here tonight in this venue. And I want to thank the students, the faculty, and administrators of the law school for welcoming us here tonight. I see Dean Soifer, Dean Antolini here. Thank you so much for having us. You know, we have a wonderful relationship between the judiciary and the law school that's benefited our community in many different ways, increasing access to justice and increasing the court's efforts to go out into the community, particularly by holding oral argument in different locations, including here at the law school and then out at high schools across the community. We were at McKinley High School in October. We had 470 students came to that oral argument. We're going to be at Baldwin High School on Maui later this month. And the law school has been a very, very important part of that through the SPOCHE program. Students for Public Outreach and Civic Education have been great partners in that program, helping prepare the students for those oral arguments. So when we go to the campuses, the students already know what the cases are about. They're not just listening to something that's abstract and inaccessible. So we're very, very fortunate to have SPOCHE's assistance. And I just want to say how much we value our ties with the law school. And there are many, many different ways in which we have such a strong relationship. Students and graduates who are externs or law clerks at our various courts, alumni who are serving as justices and judges, including my colleague, Justice Sabrina McKenna. And we have individuals who really have been the heart and soul of both institutions, C.J. Richardson, and of course, here I'm thinking of Jim Burns, the Honorable James S. Burns, who passed away recently and whose memory is going to be honored next week, both at the Supreme Court and here in the courtyard of the law school where he loved spending time. And again, it's just one more example of how closely woven the two institutions are. We're very grateful for that. And I want to thank again everyone who made this possible, Dean Soifer, Dean Ronnie Kawakami, who's here somewhere back there. I've got my reading glasses, not my distance glasses on, so it makes it hard. I haven't broken down and gotten bifocals yet, but maybe I'll have to. But, I want to thank Liam Skilling for all his work, Sam Fulmer, who was just great to work with, and again, thank you to all of them for making this possible, and look forward to having a Q&A with the students in a few moments, and thank Liam and Dean Soifer for moderating that discussion. So once again, thank you all for attending, and aloha.
Please rise. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is adjourned until further notice.